Thanks for listening to The Treatment. So I bet you're curious about what gadget you'll be using next, or maybe you're like me, you just want to visit the most cutting-edge museums. So KCRW is a podcast, DNA, that sheds light on the culture and trends in design and architecture, hosted by an industry insider. Check it out. I think you'll dig it. Find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may know my guests, Scott Alexander and Leah Karaszewski, from their, what we can say, their biographical dramas. How about we put it that way? From 20 years ago when they worked with Tim Burton on Ed Wood. They've also done The People vs. Larry Flint, A Man in the Moon, about the incredible life of Andy Kaufman. But they've also done comedies, Problem Child, and suspense films, an adaptation of Stephen King's 1408. Their newest film as writers, again working with Tim Burton, is the film Big Eyes. Guy Sursaw, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Elvis.
And jump in, whoever wants to tell us what the movie's about.
The movie is about, it's kind of the amazing tale of Walter and Margaret Keane. Walter was kind of the guy who invented the mass marketing of art. The Keens were not accepted in art circles, so they sort of did this crazy end run where they built their own galleries, put out their own coffee table books. And Walter kind of figured out that art critics didn't matter, that if you got a picture of your painting with a celebrity, then you could sell prints to middle America. And he figured out how to make the prints as cheap as possible. And so he sort of like figured out a way of getting his art into Woolworths, into, you know, the department stores, into grocery stores, and became the biggest selling artist of the 60s. But there's a secret tale underneath.
Oh, there's a twist.
Yes.
Well, that twist is.
Okay, well, Larry just took the first idea of the movie, which is the high art, low art ideas. Right. But the big twist-a-roo is that Walter wasn't actually the painter. His wife, Margaret, was the painter. She was locked in the back room of the house for 10 years, cranking out at factory-like levels these paintings of sad children. Margaret was this very passive woman. She was sort of an exaggerated version of a mid-century American wife who was sort of afraid to contradict her husband and stand in front of him. And she allowed him to appropriate her art and tell everybody that he was the real painter for 10 years.
First of all, when I saw the movie, we ran at the LA County Museum a few weeks ago, I was struck by how much it sort of reminded me of Rebecca.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. No, because Rebecca's a funny movie, because I always say, why doesn't she just ask him if he loved his first wife? Why? Just one conversation would end the entire film.
And then you wrote the movie. You went, oh,
exactly.
I get it.
But no, very much so. And I think
there's also scenes in this movie that remind me of Marnie.
Yeah. No, it definitely has a Hitchcockian feel to it at times. I think it's one of the reasons why we like working with Tim is as unafraid as we are to mix tones or mix genres in the middle of a movie, where this movie goes from like a love story to, you know, kind of an art con movie to a Hitchcockian thriller, where it's really about a 50s blonde trapped in a house.
Oh, wait, Larry, we're screwing up. We're supposed to say it's a comedy.
Oh, it's a comedy.
Oh, but folks, it's a comedy.
I would say that actually you introduced this as biographical dramas. I mean, I think what makes our biopics different than everybody else's is that they have a kind of a sarcastic edge to them. I would say they're almost their comedies. They're comedies first.
You guys write a lot about transformation. I mean, that's when it runs through the films you've done about somebody being transformed and also about a woman being kind of this repository of common sense. Certainly we can go back to Ed Wood, where finally it's both Sarah Jessica Parker and Patricia Arquette going, what's wrong with you people?
Exactly.
Yeah, Sarah Jessica, she's the only character in the film who says, these films are bad.
And probably the scene that we were most proud of in our career is is when Ed tells Patricia Arquette that he's a transvestite, and she just simply says, okay. You know, and for the first time, Ed is being accepted 100%, and it's a plea for tolerance in a weird way, and it's I think key to also our approach to these kind of fringe characters, that we're very non-judgmental of them, and that when Patricia Arquette says okay, it's kind of our attitude towards all these characters.
But in that thing too, when you're talking about comedy, those relationships, the man-woman relationships, tend to be a lot about comedy, the comedy of these kind of power dynamics of women really not having power because they're basically all set in past eras.
Mm-hmm.
each of these films in this way has sort of been about that shift in attitudes a little bit.
Well, this movie particularly.
I would lobby for Courtney and Larry Flynn. Mm-hmm. Althea Flynn was quite a powerful woman.
She was the smartest girl in the room.
But she had to go into that world with him to exert that power.
Yeah, and then at a certain point she literally takes over the magazine.
Right. She has to.
Right. Yes.
So transforming from an underage stripper in a nightclub to a person who's running a multimillion-dollar corporation, you know.
But
in this film, I think we're really, lucky or not, but the transformation for Margaret is also framed by kind of what was happening in America in a very subtle way. We do it in the film, but she starts as this 50s stand-by-your-man housewife, and by the end of the movie, it feels like about 1971, and so it's the beginning of the women's movement, and you kind of feel like she's going through that transformation that I think a lot of American women were, where she sort of, you know, learns to speak in her own voice and stand up, you know, for what's hers.
So we didn't want her to sort of be cognizant of what was happening outside her house.
Right.
She's really just trying to live her own life.
Well, that becomes a kind of interesting structure, too, because there's so often about these people being in these places, these homes or the studio or the offices of Flint Publications, or even the nightclubs, where they're in these little microcosms
that keep
the rest of the world out.
Right. Well, we're very much – we like when we're writing about process. And for us, it's also the workplace. You know, you're really talking about the two things that most people live in. They either live in their home or they live in the workplace. And so when we're doing these biographies of people who've accomplished something, even if what they've accomplished is kind of questionable, a lot of it is hard work. I think what we like is when we tell these people's stories is to tell the stories about kind of why you want to remember them. And a lot of times in other bios, it's more about, oh, that he's an alcoholic or that he had this relationship with his mother or something. And so that they don't really – it isn't really the crux of what made them who they are. And so for the Keens, it's about their art. For Larry Flynn, it was about pornography. For Ed Wood, it was making supernatural thrillers.
It's the treatment. We're trying to figure out what these guys do exactly. My guests are Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. Their newest film as writers is the Tim Burton-directed film Big Eyes. But one of the things I think is so much fun about the movies, and let's get to your affection for film, is that the movies at a certain point have like the rhythms and energy of screwball comedy, that kind of back and forth. And that's very much something I think about when I see your films.
Yeah, I mean, we can't stop ourselves from trying to make a joke. So, yeah, there is a banter-like quality to most of the dialogue. I mean, we're best off when we work with a guy like Tim or a guy like Mr. Milos Forman, who are not afraid of mixing the tones. So they're happy to leave those jokes in the middle of an otherwise serious scene. And a lot of directors are afraid of that kind of mix.
I mean, because all the time we used to get notes where like, oh, this is a drama. You can't have a joke in there because that's going to break the mood. Where someone like Milos really appreciates that. I mean, he you know, think of something like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is probably the best mixture of comedy and drama ever, where it's just like it's hysterically funny at times and it's heartbreaking. And so, you know, he really brought that to the work he did with us.
But I think part of this, that tone you're talking about, that being able to temper comedy and drama, comes from the fact that these people are engaged. You talked about process, but what seemed at the time as absurd propositions, starting a porno magazine in Ohio, or doing these paintings, or making these terrible movies, or being a comedian who basically never broke character. I mean, these are some things that to the outside world looked insane. So a lot of the comedy comes from the fact that these are people who are working these really, I'm not going to say marginal, but these outsider propositions.
Marginal is fair.
Yeah. But they're swimming upstream. I think that's what made us, you know, embrace this semi-genre that we created, which is the anti-great man, which is sort of these people who were, because we hate most movie bios because they're 3 hours long and they're about someone doing something noble, and stumbling into these kind of characters, we realize that their lives are constantly in conflict because society is constantly telling them they're wrong and what they're doing is absurd, and or it's the worst movies of all time, or it's the worst art of all time, or you should go to jail for publishing naked pictures, or, hey, what is this? You're a comedian who doesn't tell jokes. You know, what they're doing is fundamentally wrong-headed at some point. But we're taking their sides for the most part and saying, and just presenting them, like, we're looking at Ed Wood, you know, saying, hey, you know, maybe his movies were bad, but he got six film features made, and he had total passion, and he really was there for his friend Bela Lugosi, and so we celebrated him for that.
But they're also, the American thing about these movies too is that these people are all incredibly ambitious, mm-hmm. and that's something that attracts you guys, isn't that the idea of ambition?
Absolutely. We love their passion. I mean, that's what every single person in every script we've written has in common. They are so determined. They believe so much in their dream. And their dream is completely screwy, but they want to make it happen.
But what's been really interesting with Big Eyes is, for the first time, that character is the antagonist as opposed to protagonist, which makes it something totally different. Walter Keane is totally one of our guys. He's totally a guy who loves to talk about himself in the third person, who's ready to make a speech. He's a salesman.
And he's grandiose,
and,
too.
Yeah, he's grandiose, and he's good at what he does. But he is what he's not is an artist. And he's taking his wife's art.
Well, I was going to say, Larry, what you guys have done in this case with Big Eyes, you kind of, that person, you split that person in half, or that person is split in half in this. Usually the archetype contains both the talent and the ambition. And in this case, you really split them apart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, because Margaret does not have the drive. Margaret just wants to paint. And in a sense, Walter makes her dream come true in that he allows her the luxury of just being in a room all day painting. Right. Along with the paints and the easels, because she's more comfortable there than she is hanging out with people in a crowded club.
Right. I mean, she'll to this day say, despite all the problems she had with Walter, that, you know, her art would still be selling for nickels in a park if it wasn't for Walter Keane. You know, Walter Keane's, you know, genius at marketing is what took her art to the next level and the recognition.
Because I just was going to get back to that too, though, the idea that these are movies that feel, in their way, in the way that movies don't anymore, shaped by movies in the way that reflects your affection for certain genres, and you do kind of mash these genres together.
Yeah.
I mean, we also have a lot of affection for the time and place that we end up portraying in these movies.
Yeah, because you've always, they're all period pieces.
Yes, they are. Like, you know, once we fell into the Keane world and we started researching it, we kind of realized, wait, this would sort of have kind of a sweet smell of success vibe to it, and sort of like kind of recreating this world of, I mean, it's a really mixed up world the Keanes were in, where it's well dressed people in nightclubs and the men are in suits and the women are in pearls and dresses, but they're in the middle of North Beach, San Francisco, which is sort of the hippest, most beatnik place on the West Coast. You had Greenwich Village and you had North Beach. So it's totally hip and progressive, but there's nothing hip and progressive about either of our characters. So we sort of just get to have like all these mushy contradictions going on at the same time. But it's a very vivid world to recreate, and that was fun.
But I do like the idea, even when you say this is kind of a problem child, and we've talked about this a couple of times later, where the dad is kind of that common sense figure. There's somebody who represents almost an insanely grounded person for whom this doesn't make sense. Do you guys write that consciously as kind of an audience surrogate figure, or is that you guys to some extent?
I don't know if it's a conscious thing. I think it's almost second nature to us now, in a sense, whatever. All, you know, the scenes have to have a conflict. So if you have a guy who's totally selling someone a bunch of nonsense, you kind of need, in order there to be a conflict, you need someone saying, hey, maybe this is not a good idea.
And the ironic joke is that the person who is just trying to argue for common sense is depicted as a villain.
Yes.
And so we've sort of got, you know, Jerry Falwell saying, just can't you be nice to people? or the Baptist and Ed Wood saying, Mr. Wood, can't you just have shots that cut together in this motion picture? Right. Or art critics saying, you know, why is this kitsch taking over our country? What happened to good values in art? And these people get so frustrated.
Well, the idea of these people who, for them, it's completely common sense, though, your protagonists, that they should succeed. I mean, that also is part of the conflict, too. It's like, I'm not wrong.
And right. They're very American in that way. They're very much the American dream. They have an idea, and it's gonna take them from rags to riches.
They're going to roll that ball up the hill as long as it takes.
I mean, whatever. Larry Flint, literally rags from riches. He was born in a cabin that didn't even have a floor. And
well, this is the point we take a break, and I'm going to go from rags to rags. It's The Treatment. My guests are Scott Alexander and Larry Karras. You can see the newest film as writers is Big Eyes. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm speaking to the writers of Big Eye, Scott Alexander and Leah Garzewski. It's their new film directed by Tim Burton. And you guys hadn't worked with Tim for a while. And this is a much more low budget canvas than he's generally worked with.
Yeah, it's the lowest budget film he's made since Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
I mean, despite what IMDb might tell you, we have had sort of a shadow career with Tim over the last 20 years, where we worked on movies that either fell apart or movies where we didn't get credit. And so there has been a relationship over the years.
So you're saying the internet is wrong, Scott?
Well, once in a while, Elvis.
Exactly.
But I mean,
Tim totally embraced the idea of making a lower budget movie. I think he really needed a palate cleanser, and he actually had approached us about doing a different project, and so that's how we knew that he was sort of game, and we knew his affection for this, because this is a movie that Scott and I have been trying to get made for 11 years, and we're trying to make it ourselves as directors. And a couple times it fell apart, once because of the financial crash, another time an actress got pregnant. And so the movie had kind of had this bad luck of stops and starts, and Christoph Waltz was kind of circling it at one point, and we went to Tim and said, what do you think? And he really got excited about the idea of Christoph, and we offered to switch places. He would direct and we would produce. We produced this movie as well as wrote it.
I mean, it's strange that Larry and I have come to represent the change of pace Tim Burton, and that both movies got made because he was just coming off these big lumbering dinosaur productions where there's this massive crew and this shoot that goes on forever, and as Tim always grouses, and we're rushing to a release date that's tied into a bunch of cereal boxes being released and lunch boxes. Right. And in both cases, he just wanted to sort of just strip it down to, let me just make something for myself where I can have a smaller crew and just calm things down.
What's funny is that most people always associate Tim, rightfully so probably, is for that gothic or that fantasy thing he does, or even like the action stuff in Batman. But we find that he's an amazing director of actors. He's an amazing director of an office scene. You know, just, you know, you talk about our stuff taking place in the workplace. He's great when it's just two people across the desk, or Ed Wood trying to get a job, or Margaret Keane trying to get a job, and it's just two actors in a desk. And he brings an empathy to the characters that is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, Larry and I got in a conversation once about, you know, how Tim is really good at two guys in a desk kind of scenes, and then we realized that basically summarizes our entire body of work. Which is, we've, you know, for like 26 years now, we've just been, 28 years, we've been writing movies about two guys in a desk. And then a friend of ours pointed out that that's what we are.
Yeah.
We're just two guys in a desk every day of our lives. And so we're just basically just writing about ourselves endlessly.
It's a treatment. My guests were not the guys who invent the walk and talk are Scott Alexander and Larry Garzewski. Their newest film is Big Eyes with Tim Burton. What I found so interesting about this movie, and I was talking to Tim a little bit about it before we did the Q&A at the museum, was that it had an energy that he hadn't brought to movies in a while. And I really find myself thinking of a lot of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, because mm-hmm. it got a lot of popping colors, which he hadn't really done so much mm-hmm. in a natural way since Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Because the other movies, if you look at even something like Charlie and Chocolate Factory, it's colorful but surreal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or abstract. And this is not. I mean, and Pee-wee is doggedly set in a kind of a real world. It could almost have been a movie you guys wrote in some ways.
Sure.
Because it's about
a
guy.
Pee-wee's great.
But it's also about a guy who has this idea of his life.
Correct.
That's
yes.
in complete
Correct.
Conflict with everybody
Correct.
Else's.
Correct.
I'm not sure if he's 30 or if he's 12.
He's not either. But, I mean, if we look at Ed Wood or Big Eyes, they fit into, to me, this sort of canon of the kind of the reality-based Tim Burton comedies. Mm-hmm.
What's even though interesting is that in Ed Wood, because of who the characters are, they are a bit heightened in the sense that they fit into that Tim Burton world almost a little bit more, because, heck, it's Bela Lugosi being Dracula, you know. So there is Ed Wood surrounded himself with kind of surreal people, Tor Johnson, where Margaret is. This is Tim's easily his most naturalistic film, because it really is, you know, about this woman.
I feel like I could make a bad case for Beetlejuice being reality-based.
Yes, you can make a very bad case for that. But what I would say, though, is that Walter is bigger than life in that way that the characters are in Ed Wood or in Larry Flint or Man on the Moon. Any movie you guys have written, there's a guy who's almost in an old-fashioned way. You mentioned Burt Lancaster, a charismatic in that way.
We always get in trouble because we write scripts and then the casting director will say, well, who do you have in mind when you're doing it? We're like, oh, Burt Lancaster, Robert Mitchum, he'd be good.
Yeah, call their agents.
Oh, they're not available. Shoot.
Yeah, they're with God. but that's the idea what I think is so much fun about your movies is that you bring a screwball comedy ethos into real life. These people who talk way too much.
Yes.
And they're constantly explaining themselves.
Well, if you take a step back from their lives are absurd. I mean, every time we'd start outlining the plot of this movie, the plot of it is ridiculous because so many strange things went down. So it is a completely absurdist tale. And, and people say, oh, did this really happen? Yeah, it happened.
Yeah. I mean, people are amazed at things that really happened. I mean, people are amazed that courtroom scene we actually had to tone down.
You told me about that. Yeah. You told me tell some of the audience what the things that
there's a very bizarre courtroom scene that's sort of the climax of our film, but Walter wound up representing himself. And when we got the Honolulu newspapers and read about it, I mean, it was completely crazy.
He was yelling at himself in the witness box and then running across the courtroom and jumping into the box and talking back to himself.
And the judge would say things like, you've got concrete between your ears, and threaten to shackle him and put duct tape over his mouth. And we had to tone that down because it was way too much. I mean, some people even would argue that it's almost too much in the movie now, but we just embraced the comedy of it.
I mean, we did cut out a bunch of his character witnesses. Yeah. He kept flying people into Honolulu to attest on his behalf. And once they would actually put their hand on the Bible and then look up, they would kind of gulp and then melt down, and they would all turn on him.
Yeah, it was like episodes of Matlock where they would melt down on the stand.
The only one who came through for Walter and we just had to restrain ourselves was Wayne Newton, flew himself to Honolulu and testified as to Walter's magnificence as a painter. So he got Wayne Newton. I don't know how he managed to not put that in the script. Yeah. And then the trial melted down and Walter lost completely. And then about 6 months later, Wayne Newton realized that Wayne Newton was wrong. And so he flew back to Hawaii on his own dime just to apologize to Margaret in person.
Right. Wow. That really meant a lot to Margaret.
That's almost a movie in and of itself.
Exactly.
But the other element that runs through these movies, too, is that your characters are all lovers of popular culture.
Right.
I mean, they're really in love with it, and they want to be part of pop culture. I mean, it's not that they just want to be stars. They want to be part of this mix that creates this stuff. And I wonder where that comes from for you guys, because I don't think I've
ever seen that comes from us. I mean, because we love pop culture.
And we love the fringes of pop culture.
Right.
We don't want to read, People Magazine or Us Weekly. We want to read just some freaky cult magazine that's self-published that just talks about some character actor from the early 1970s that no one's heard of.
Right.
That's the stuff we like.
But that idea of being a part of the world of pop culture in the kind of an innocent time, I mean, it's almost in some ways, I keep thinking about old movies again. I mean, the adage of Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney getting together and let's put on a show. Mm-hmm. It's almost a part of all these things you've done. The people who group these band together to put these things on because it means so much to them. And in some ways, that's a success just so they get to do it. You talked about process, but also just getting to do it is an achievement in and of itself for a lot of these people.
Sure.
This sort of phenomenon we talk about this between ourselves, which is that a lot of these characters are sort of like kids like putting on their dad's coats and then pretending to be adults.
No, totally. I mean, Ed Wood is that. I mean, Ed Wood is pretending to be a director. He's got the bullhorn. He's almost like Jethro Bodine in the Beverly Hillbillies when he pretends to be a director. He's like an old-fashioned silent movie director. And Walter Keane is not an artist, but he plays one. You know, he plays, and so when he describes himself, he does that thing that frauds kind of do. He compares himself to Michelangelo and Gauguin, and he lies too big.
It's a treatment. The first time in 17 years somebody's brought Jethro Bodine on this show. My guests are Scott Alexander and Larry Carazusi. The new film is writers is Big Eyes. But that idea of also taking us backstage a little bit, I mean, the elements that sort of takes, and the chemistry that happens in a room, it's like in some way your lead characters, be it Larry Flint or Andy Kaufman or Walter Keane, are kind of casting their lives around them. They're creating a narrative around themselves, mm-hmm. which appends itself to the idea that so many of them talking about themselves in the third person.
Right. Well, that we really knew when we were writing the Larry Flynt project was that Larry Flynt was aware of his own legend. He was very much aware of the fact that he saw his story as a boy born in a log cabin who makes $100 million and runs for president and gets shot for what he believes in. You know, he actually was aware of that. And so writing Man on the Moon, Andy wasn't around, you know, at least that we can talk about. but Bob Zamuda was. And Zamuda also is one of these guys.
We had to sign some paperwork. Yeah.
In 5 more years, we can talk. But Zamuda is totally one of these characters who just print the legend.
I mean, but that idea of creating mythology,
yes,
almost in a way reminds me of Preston Sturges. We often characters in Sturges who are talking, creating a narrative for themselves.
Sure.
And aware of the story that they're leading their own lives. Right. For me, an obvious question to ask you guys about the influence of that Sturges world. Or Hail the Conquering Hero, or Palm Beach Story, or any movie you can sort of think of, Sullivan's Travels, where there's a conscious creation of a narrative,
right,
in a life. And this happens in all these biographical films you've done.
Yeah. I mean, what's fun with some of these people is how willing they are to accept the narrative that we end up cooking up just to cram a lifetime into 2 hours. And, I mean, we are particularly amused. I mean, Larry Flynt and Bob Zamuda and a bit of a sense Margaret Keane have all accepted the 3-act structure, 2-hour version of their lives we've presented, where we are clearly having to leave out a lot of stuff and move a few things around just to fit it into, okay, end of the first act is page 30, end of the second act is page 90. And it's really funny just to see them not even blink at some of the stuff that's missing.
But you guys seem to be attracted to incidents or pieces of somebody's life that lends itself to a 3-act structure.
Right.
It almost is like not like you're imposing it, but you seem your compass is almost pointed in that
direction. Well, we're imposing it in the sense that—
No, I get that you're doing that. Yeah. There has to be an imposition because, like you're saying, there has to be the process of editing and elision. But still, these things that you're attracted to, these pieces of time—
Well, I think anyone who's writing a good biopic is just doing their job well if they are looking for those moments that can be structural. When Walter Keane and the New York Times art critic got in a big battle over whether or not the Keane's art was good enough to present in the World's Fair, neither of them was thinking that this would be a good end of a second act. But for us, you know, if we move around a few incidents, we can position it correctly.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, once again, I get back to the fact that most biographies on film are kind of really dull or stodgy. And what we fight against is that. And so we try to structure it like a regular movie. And we don't do Cradle to the Grave. We don't do, you know,
the anti-great man theory.
Yeah. And we just do as little time as possible. We sort of ask that general question, why is this person remembered? And that usually winds up being the climax. Because that's their triumph. The movie should still end with some kind of triumph, or at least some bittersweet victory. And then you kind of, you know, structure things backwards. I mean, for example, on the Larry Flynt movie, we knew that the climax would be that Supreme Court case. And the Supreme Court case, the client doesn't speak at the Supreme Court. The lawyer does. So just doing that, you say, oh, my gosh, that Ed Norton character is going to have to be important. We're going to have to structure him throughout the entire project, you know. So all of a sudden, by figuring out what's the important thing in their life, it allows you to kind of realize how you're going to have to structure the movie.
Guys, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, great. Well, my guests, who clearly have a lot of common sense, are Scott Alexander and Larry Carazusi. Their new film, As Writers, is Big Eyes. Recording engineer who also mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radlett. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.